Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hi, everyone. This is Megan DeZura with Hot Topics in U.S. Immigration. And today, the biggest topic to talk about is the H-1B lottery. H-1B quota is officially over. The cap closed on March 25th. USCIS gave us a surprise extension. They extended it from March 22nd to March 25th due to some system errors in the USCIS website. I'm sure many attorneys can attest to the errors they were seeing with the system, but hopefully everyone got all the registrations in. And now we just wait for USCIS to make their selections. So the selections are going to be made by April 1st, is what USCIS announced. And as a reminder, there are 65,000 bachelor's cap slots open, and then 20,000 slots open for those who attended U.S. master's programs. So just as a recap, before we get into the meat of the presentation, there have been, you know, upward trend of demand for H-1Bs in the past years. And of course, the USCIS has not released more visas as the demand has increased. So in recent years, the H-1B quota demand for H-1Bs has gone up, and the number of H-1Bs released each year has not gone up. USCIS has kept that number stagnant as per regulations. So last year, for fiscal year 2024, eligible registrations, there were 780,000 registrations. Those selected, it was only 188,000 selected. So that's a very small percentage of those registered. We're hoping this year for better numbers, with USCIS changing the way that they select beneficiaries, and they are making a more beneficiary-centric selection process. So hopefully everyone's percentages are higher, and companies just see better numbers overall. I also briefly wanted to mention that there have been additional selections in previous years. There have been like additional rounds of selection. Typically, the first additional round somewhere in the summer. And of course, USCIS did not announce this ahead of time last year. So we got the initial selections in April, and then they did an additional round in July. So unclear as if that's going to happen again. It will really just, we'll have to wait and see. We'll see how many initial selections there are, what the percentages look like. And then from there, we can kind of predict whether we think USCIS is going to do an additional round of selections, but it's always up to USCIS. And again, they don't really give any heads up for that. So the biggest thing I wanted to talk about today is what to do if your employee was not selected in the lottery. So small chance of selection, say you have several people in the lottery and your employee, April 1st comes around and your employee is not selected. And so you're faced with what to do to keep their work authorization or to hire them initially. If you were doing a lottery registration for someone that you hope to hire. So I'm going to take this time to explore some other visa options and just give an overview of some other options open to foreign nationals that want to work in the US or maybe weren't aware of this option previously. So First of all, there is an H1B1. This is slightly different than the H1B. The H1B1 is only for Singaporean or Chilean citizens. Much like the H1B, there is a lottery. However, the lottery is not usually filled. So there's a limited number of petitions, but it has not been filled in recent years or ever since I've been practicing. It has never been filled. So chances are there is a visa available for a Singaporean or a Chilean citizen. Again, this is the H1B1. It's also a specialty occupation visa. This means that in order to be eligible for this visa, the employee or the candidate for employment has to have a equivalent to a bachelor's degree. And then they also need to be working in a role that requires a bachelor's degree. So this would not be available for a position that needs only a high school education or no education. It has to be in a bachelor's degree or higher, a requirement for a bachelor's degree or higher. And then the person has to also have that equivalent degree. So the good thing about the H1B1, it can be filed within the US or it can be filed directly at the US consulate abroad. So if someone is abroad and someone was waiting for this H1B lottery selection to be able to enter the US, once the H1B was approved, this visa can be applied for at the consulate. This provides a one-year admission period if you're applying at USCIS, 18 months if you're applying at the consulate. But the great thing about the H1B1 is this can be extended indefinitely. So the H1B has a six-year limit in the US, but the H1B1, because this is a treaty visa, it actually can continue to be extended as long as the visa holder continues to meet the requirements. And as long as, of course, the role continues to require the bachelor's degree and the person continues to meet the requirements of the role. If the person in the H1B1 does get selected in an H1B in a later year, like if the employer wants to continue putting them into the lottery to get that actual H1B, the time in H1B status does actually count against the H1B six-year limit. So if you are in H1B1 for 5 years and then you're finally selected in the H1B, you would only have that 1 year in H1B status left. H1B can be extended past the 6 years if you reach a certain part in the green card process. But again, the H1B1 still counts towards that six-year limit in the H1B status. So another treaty visa that is another good option for someone who may be eligible for an H1B, their role may be eligible for an H1B, but they're not selected in the cap, would be the E3. And this is specifically for Australian citizens. So this is another specialty occupation visa, again, specific to Australians. And this one has a 2-year admission period. This is the same as the H1B1, where you can file this with USCIS in the country or in the US, or you can file this outside the US with the actual consulate in Australia. And this one also has the same requirements as the H1B, meaning the job has to require a bachelor's degree or higher, and the candidate or employee has to also have a bachelor's degree or higher, or a equivalent of a bachelor's degree. So this one, similar to the H1B1, it can be extended indefinitely. It has that 2-year period first, but it can be extended indefinitely. The E3 actually does not count towards H1B limits. If you switch from an E3 to an H1B, the E3 time does not count toward that 6-year limit.
I will say for the H1, B1, and the E3, these can be extended indefinitely, but they also, which is a great plus of these visas, the downside of these visas and why someone may still want to go into the H1B lottery the following year is that these are not dual intent visas. This means that when someone enters the U.S. in an H1B1 or an E3, they are declaring their intent to be on a temporary non-immigrant visa in the U.S., work pursuant to this non-immigrant visa, and then eventually return home. They're not saying that they want to come and pursue a green card and remain in the U.S. as a legal permanent resident. So those are the downsides to these visas. Since they can be extended indefinitely, often people want to stay here, start a life in the U.S., but they aren't dual intent. So they do carry restrictions with them if you do start the green card process. It's not impossible to pursue a green card while on a non-dual intent visa, but there are restrictions. So that's why often people want to still continue to be put into H-1B lottery, even if they're not selected, and even if they are on an H-1B1 or an E-3, they may continue to register for the next year and the next year until they're selected in the H-1B lottery. So another non-immigrant visa option, and this would be for our neighbors in the north or the south, for Canadian or Mexican citizens, is the TN professional visa. So this one is also a treaty visa with the USMCA, and this is exclusively for those in Canada or Mexico. They have to be a Canadian or a Mexican citizen, and this is a 3-year admission period that can also be extended indefinitely. So this TN can be filed with USCIS or the consulate if you are a Mexican citizen. If you are a Canadian citizen, it can be filed with USCIS, but it also could be applied for at the actual port of entry. This is slightly different than some of the other visas because Canadians do not need an actual visa in their passport to enter the US. They can use their Canadian passport. So instead of having to go to the consulate and attend a visa appointment, Canadians can just go to a port of entry to the U.S. and present their documents, and their TN petition will be adjudicated at that port of entry. This is similar to the specialty occupation visa in that there are specific requirements, but it's not necessarily the bachelor's degree requirement. So the TN has specific professions that were identified when the NAFTA treaty was in place and they created this visa. So there are specific professions that have specific academic requirements outlined for the TN. If you can imagine a kid in kindergarten, you ask them, what do you want to be when they grow up? And any occupation that they may say that they want to be, those are the occupations in the TN professional list. They're very, very general and have not really aged well with technology. For example, for a computer occupation, the only real computer-specific occupation is computer systems analyst. There's no software engineer or applications engineer, you really have to get creative to figure out where your job for your TN candidate may fit into these specific TN professions. There's, you know, a lawyer, doctor, there is an engineer, and what the actual professions, TN professions list has is academic requirements for each specific profession. So there are professions on the list that don't require an actual bachelor's degree. They may require an associate's degree or like the Canadian equivalent to an associate's degree. So it has a bit more flexibility in what the candidate may have if they don't have a bachelor's degree. However, the TN can be a little bit more stringent when trying to fit some of our more modern day jobs into these very broad jobs for the TN category. The TN, like I said, is non-dual intent, but it does not count toward any type of H-1B limit if you are selected in the H-1B at a later time. So often someone in a TN, if they want to start a green card process, they may continue to go into the H-1B lottery because they want that flexibility when pursuing a green card. So the next visa option that is not restricted to a specific country is the O-1 Extraordinary Ability. So the O-1 is often thought of as a backup to the H-1B lottery, but keep in mind with the O-1, it is reserved for established professionals in the industry that have sustained national or international acclaim and are someone that has risen to the very top of their industry. So this could be in research. It could be in academics specifically. This could also be in business or finance, but the individual has to prove that they are someone who has really reached like the pinnacle in their field. So often this is shown by publications that they have written, like scientific publications. It may be shown by receipt of a high salary in the past or that their offer letter has a high salary. This could be shown by publications about the actual person. You can also show that they have a major internationally recognized award. The example that's always given is the Nobel Prize. However, it's rare that you're going to find someone who's received the Nobel Prize. So usually individuals who are going after the O-1 are showing some of those other criteria, such as publications, scholarly articles. If someone's a researcher, having a lot of citations to their work, that is something that can be shown. If someone is in academics, like if they have a PhD, if they can show that they have like mentored other grad students, they're part of PhD committees of other grad students, that's something that can be shown as well. It really depends. The evidence really depends on the type of area and industry that they're working in. So this is typically successful for those in like a higher position. A group of people that often use the O-1 could be like the founder of a company, the founder of a startup. The O-1 has some flexibility in the ownership, in showing ownership of a company. So a lot of times founders may use this, founders of a startup or someone who has stock ownership in a company. This category, it's tough for people who are using this as a backup to the H-1B because it's not usually recommended for individuals who have just graduated from university, which a lot of times someone in their first H-1B cap may be new graduates. Usually someone who has just graduated from university wouldn't be able to show the high achievement yet. They may have the basis for a good O-1, but they may not have risen to the very top of their field. And again, the O-1 is not really for someone who's a rising star. It's for someone who is already established in their field. All that being said, it's still a good option if you have a really high performer and they're not selected in the lottery. We have seen USCIS be a bit more flexible with the O-1 and how high-achieving O-1 candidates have to be, specifically if they are in a STEM field. So if someone is in a STEM field and working on some really extraordinary work in your company, that could still be an option to pursue, especially if they are ending their, say, F1, they're ending their F1 OPT and they don't have another option. An O-1 could be something to at least try to provide them longer work authorization. The O-1, it's sort of a quasi-dual intent visa. You have some more flexibility when you're pursuing green card on the O-1. The O-1 can be extended indefinitely, so that's another great part of the O-1. Like I said, it's not restricted to a specific country. And if you switch from the O-1 to the H-1B, no time on the O-1 counts toward the H-1B limit, so that is not a concern. The O-1, the initial time of approval is 3 years, but like I said, it can be extended indefinitely. The downside to that indefinite extension is that each year you'd have to file an extension. So the O-1 has the initial 3-year approval, but then you have to extend in 1-year increments. So because of the amount of work that goes into an O-1, since you are trying to establish someone being at the top of their field and having to gather a lot of evidence, it can be a burdensome petition to have to file every year. So that's also something to keep in mind with the O-1. So other visa options that someone may have could be a dependent status if they have a spouse who is working in the U.S. So if someone's spouse is on an L-1, which is like a multinational manager transferred to the U.S., L-2, which is the spousal visa for L-1s, L-2s have automatic employment authorization in the U.S. So that's something to explore, certainly if someone has a spouse in the U.S. E-3 spouses also have automatic employment authorization if their E-3 spouse is working in the U.S. If someone is the spouse of an H-1B visa holder, then the H-4 spousal visa is employment authorized with an employment authorization document. And an H-4 spouse can apply for that if their H-1B spouse has an I-140. So their H-1B spouse would have to be in the green card process and have reached that I-140 stage in order for the H-4 to apply for a employment authorization document or EAD. The J-2, if someone is here on a J-1 and their spouse is in J-2, they can apply for a work authorization as well. And then there's also an EAD that's available for someone who is here based on a pending green card. So that could be a green card that their spouse has filed through their company. It could be a family-based green card, but there is the option to apply for an employment authorization document if you have a pending green card application. So another question, probably one of the most frequent questions that we get as immigration attorneys, if someone is not selected in the CAP, is what if I go back to school and start a academic program that has day one CPT. So CPT is practical training that is provided by some academic programs in the U.S. A lot of four-year programs offer CPT, but usually CPT is not offered until someone has been in the program for one academic year. So a lot of students in the U.S. use this so that they can work in internships off campus and work for, say, an employer that then may employ them after school, after they graduate and have an EAD card based on their, say, completion of a bachelor's degree. The problem is that what people usually look at when they are looking for an academic program to join, if they are not selected in the CAP, is they are looking at programs that have day one CPT. So this day one work authorization. So the issue with this is that the legitimacy of day one CPT programs is often questioned by USCIS. One of the major questions that USCIS has is, you know, if someone is taking a master's program and doing a full-time master's program, how do they also have time to do full-time work at an employer with this CPT operation or authorization, work authorization? So it typically results in increased scrutiny in a future immigration petition. Typically, their CPT work may not be impacted, but where we would see this questioning and the scrutiny would be if someone is then selected in, say, next year's CAP, and we file a petition to change someone from F1 to H1B, and they have been working pursuant to CPT in a program that allowed for day one CPT, we may see USCIS question that and ask for more details about the CPT, more details that the individual actually attended the classes, that it was a full-time program, and that this program really needed this day one work authorization to complete the program requirements. So typically, employees, if they want to work on CPT with an academic program, they would be working with their school to obtain this work authorization. It's not usually something that a legal team helps out with, just because the school program, an international student program, is usually the one who gathers all the paperwork for that. But that's just a warning about day one CPT, is it's not always highly recommended. Those are all my CAP alternatives. I hope that everyone has a good rest of their week, and I hope that we see really high selection numbers in the coming days. April 1st is when USCIS says that they are going to release all the selections. So good luck, everyone, and have a great weekend.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.